Let me start by saying that both Justice Ginsburg and I have in common an incredibly important thing that I want to mention, and that is we were both married to feminist men. And I think that she would say, and I was lucky enough to know Marty Ginsburg, who was not just one of the great tax lawyers of all time, but one of the great human beings of all time. And I know how he supported her in every way. And those of you who know my husband, Dr. Barry Ramo, Channel 7 News, also know that he is the most supportive person in the world. And when times were tough for me, in varying ways, he constantly pointed out, Justice Ginsburg, as I have a feeling Marty may have to you, that it was how you finished things, not how you started things, that made all the difference. So I can only claim that one single thing in common with Justice Ginsburg, but I claim it all the time. Let me start out by asking you, Justice Ginsburg, we think New Mexico is the most wonderful place on the planet. How was it that you, who I think had never been farther west than Fort Sill, Oklahoma, came to Santa Fe, and what keeps you coming back every year?
All of you know what keeps coming me back. One is the opera. I came here for the opera, but the other is the sky, both in the morning and at night. And when I go back to Washington, D.C. tomorrow, I'm going to miss my sky enormously. But how did I start coming?
Please.
I met at the 10th Circuit Judicial Conference. The United States is divided into circuits for federal courts. And New Mexico is included in the 10th Circuit, which also covers Colorado and Oklahoma. My first year on the U.S. Supreme Court, I was assigned to be the circuit justice for the 10th Circuit. They were meeting in Denver, and they were dedicating a courthouse to my predecessor, Byron White. And at that conference, I met a judge, Oliver Seth, who was a longtime member of the Court of Appeals for several years, its chief judge. And I met his wife, Jean Seth. And Jean said to me, "I understand you like opera. You should come to Santa Fe." And I thought about it, and then Jean came to visit me at the court. She was on the visiting committee for the Museum of American Art in D.C. She renewed the invitation. I started coming the next year. Jean was always my host and social planner. It's sad that she's no longer with us, but her two daughters are here at this program. So that was how I started coming to Santa Fe, and I think apart from 1 year, I've been here ever since.
And we are so grateful, all of us, to have you. But I have to say, there are people in this audience who knew Jean Seth very well, and they knew she was pretty much a force of nature. So if she told you to come to Santa Fe, even a Supreme Court judge would come to Santa Fe. There wasn't that much question about it. So since I think it would be interested, we're all so proud of the Santa Fe Opera, which is, we think, a world-class opera company. What first caused your great passion for opera? Was that something you enjoyed as a child, or did you fall in love with it later in life?
I was 11 when I was turned on to opera, and this is a story I've told many times. I had an aunt who was a junior high school teacher, and she took me to a mini opera put on in one of the high schools in Brooklyn. It was done by a man named Dean Dixon. He abbreviated operas into 1 hour. The principal arias were sung, and he narrated in between. There were costumes, there was bare staging. And I had never experienced anything like it. The glorious music, the high drama. It was the most unlikely first opera. It was La Gioconda. This was in the middle 40s. Eventually, Dean Dixon left the United States. He was a man who was before his time. He was African American at a time when African Americans didn't conduct, at least not in the United States. So he left the United States and went to Europe, and I believe had a flourishing career there. And when I told this story once on a radio show, I got so many emails and calls by people who had been introduced to opera by this incredibly wonderful man.
It's so interesting. My first opera was the first season of the Santa Fe Opera, and it was Madame Butterfly. And one of the mother of one of my friends, I was going to be a ballet dancer. It didn't work out for me. And said, you know, you really should come to the opera. And we went, and I saw it in the old theater with the water in front of it, and I fell in love and have been in love ever since myself. So I understand completely. There is something so wonderful, and the chance to hear great music and exquisite singing in our air, I think, makes it even more special. Well, Justice Ginsburg, this conference is about risk and reinvention. So I wanted to ask you, you were a scholar and a teacher, the only person, I think, to have been on both the Harvard and Columbia Law Reviews. And what made you decide to suddenly become active as an advocate in women's rights? And what made you decide that the court was the battleground that you were going to fight on?
I was fantastically lucky to be born when I was and to be working on a law faculty where there was, my time was not captive of any client. I say I was fantastically lucky because for the generation before, even 10 years before, there were women saying the same things that we were saying, just give women a fair chance and they will hold up at least half the world. So that things were changing in society in the 60s. There was first the civil rights movement, and then there was International Women's Year declared by the UN and the planning for that. So the women's movement came alive, and society changed. I can point to one difference in a 10-year span. My children are 10 years apart. When my daughter, the older, went to grade school, there were no other working mothers. But 10 years later, that picture had changed. So there was an opportunity for the law to catch up to the changes that were occurring in women's and men's lives. So it was the first time in history when there was a chance to get the Supreme Court to move in a different direction. Some people remember the quote, liberal Warren Court. Well, I'll tell you the one gender discrimination case that came before that court. The petitioner for Supreme Court review was a woman named Gwendolyn Hoyt. We would today call her a battered woman. And one day, her philandering husband so humiliated her, she was beside herself. It's a little bit like Billy Budd in the opera when Claggart accuses him and Billy can't speak and he strikes out at Claggart. Well, Gwendolyn Hoyt spotted her young son's broken baseball bat in the corner of the room. She took it and with all her might, she hit him over the head. He fell on a stone floor. It was the end of the argument. It was the end of the husband and the beginning of the murder prosecution. Gwendolyn Hoyt was from a woman from Florida. Florida did not put women on the jury rolls. Gwendolyn Hoyt thought women on the jury might understand her rage. And maybe they wouldn't acquit her, but perhaps they would convict her of the lesser offense of manslaughter, not murder. Well, she was convicted by an all-male jury of murder. And that case came to the, quote, liberal Warren Court. And the court said, we don't understand this complaint. Women have the best of both worlds. They can serve on juries. All they have to do is go to the clerk's office and sign up. They don't want to serve. They don't have to. And you can imagine Gwendolyn Hoyt reading this Supreme Court decision and thinking, what about me? Have they thought about me? But the notion of the court was, this is a favor to women. They're excused. We don't put them on the jury roll. But the point that the court failed to notice then, and it certainly noticed 10 years later, was that if you say that women are not needed for jury service, you're treating them as less than full citizens, because citizens have obligations as well as rights, and serving on a jury is one of the obligations of citizenship. But it took the social change that was occurring in the 60s for the court to understand that message. So it was during Chief Justice Burger's watch that the court declared systems that automatically excused women unconstitutional and said, yes, if men are needed to serve the system of justice, women are too. Women are not expendable. So I say, how did we? I was trying to explain that how I was the beneficiary of it,
right.
The change in society that made the arguments. The court was just beginning to understand that these favors to women were often, as Justice Brennan once put it, not putting women on a pedestal, but in a cage. I mean, another good example is Gossett against Cleary. The Gossetts were a mother and a daughter who owned a tavern. And the daughter was her mother's bartender. The state of Michigan passed a law that said women can't serve drinks unless they are the wife or the daughter of the owner of the tavern. Well, this was a law that instantly put mother and daughter Gossett out of business. But when it came to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1948, the court made light of this, and they spoke about barrooms as being unsavory places. Now, nobody noticed that the restriction was on tending bar when you're behind the bar. There was no restriction on being a waitress and bringing the drinks to the table where you were in much greater jeopardy. But that's the way things were. And although women were arguing against this, women brought the case Gossett against Cleary to the Supreme Court and Hoyt against Florida. The court wasn't ready to listen. It was in the 70s, and that's because society has changed. You know, the courts are not in the vanguard of social change. They tend to trail behind society. But what they were doing in the 70s, they were catching up to a change that was already occurring in the way people live.
You know, I have to say, Justice Ginsburg, because everybody in this room might not know, that you were our NAACP. You argued 6 cases for women in front of the Supreme Court, and you won 5. And I think they were wrong about the last.
Yes, they were. They were.
So you reinvented yourself from a scholar, and you were an amazing scholar. Somebody suggested, I know, that perhaps you should go study the Swedish law of civil procedure. And you did what any person would do, right? You learned Swedish. And then you reinvented your life again when you went on the bench. So what were there hard parts? Did you feel it was at all risky to leave your life as a teacher and an advocate to go on the bench? And what were the hardest things you found when you were first put on the Court of Appeals?
Perhaps I should first explain how I got to the bench, because people sometimes ask me, did you always want to be a Supreme Court justice? And I had to answer, when I graduated from law school, I wanted to get a job in the law, any job in the law. The idea of a woman being a judge was just in the realm of the fantastic. But then we had a president, Jimmy Carter, who looked around at the federal courts and said, you know, those judges, they all look like me. But that's not how the great United States looks. So I want my judges to show the diversity of the great United States and not just one segment of our country. So he made an effort to appoint women and members of minority groups in numbers, and no president ever went back to the way it was. I mean, think of President Reagan. Didn't want to be outdone by President Carter, so he made a nationwide search to appoint the first woman to the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor. So it was Jimmy Carter breaking what had been the pattern. It was the first time I ever conceived of the possibility of a life on the bench. Well, I had been a flaming feminist advocate for 10 years. And it decided, you know, most of what we set out to do, we accomplished. And what we set out to do was to take the laws, both state laws and federal laws, law books that were riddled with gender-based discrimination, and get them changed. Our first target was the legislature. And if the legislature didn't move, then the court was the next resort. But by the end of that decade, almost all of the explicit gender classifications were gone, almost all. So I thought it was a good time for me to see what life was like on the other side of the bench. So I was one of 11 judges that Jimmy Carter appointed to courts of appeals. He appointed over 25 to trial courts, to federal district courts. And what was the life like? Well, it wasn't such a big change for me. I mean, I spent 17 years as a law teacher. And what does a law teacher do? Well, prepares for class, and then there's the class, and then you go back to your office with, in those days, your pad of paper, now your PC, and you think, you read, you write. That's the life of an appellate judge. So I think that being a law teacher and being an appellate judge are closer than any other two ways of working at the law. I mean, the one big difference was if you are a law teacher and you're working on your great magnum opus and you don't like it, so you put it in the drawer for a while, and maybe you come back to it 6 months later. As a judge, you don't have that luxury. I mean, people need an answer to the question now so they can go on with their lives. So the pressure to come out with your opinion in a reasonable amount of time, big difference.
Well, I have to note one particular point because I think it's so important and is forgotten sometimes now, and that is the importance of feminist men in advancing the cause of women. As you said, President Carter decided this is not right. In my own case, I too couldn't find a job. And in fact, Phil Neal, who was then the dean of the University of Chicago Law School, called me into his office in March of the year I was to graduate. And he said, "Ramo, what's wrong with you? You're the only person in the class without a job." And I explained that I'd written to every, Barry was then going on the faculty at Duke, that I'd written to every law firm I could find in North Carolina and every government agency, and nobody had even had the courtesy to reply. So he picked up the phone and called the only person I guess he knew in North Carolina, who was Terry Sanford, who had just finished being the governor. And with me sitting right there like I was chopped liver, this was before everybody had speakerphones, I hear him say, "Sanford, what the hell is wrong with your state?" And he told me to go see Terry Sanford, which I did. He helped me find a very important job for me in North Carolina. But again, I went to sit before him in his office in Raleigh. This was before he was the president of Duke. He talks to me for a few minutes. He dials the phone. He asks to speak to Phil Neal. He says, "Neal, she'll do," and hangs up. So that's how we do what we do. It never occurred to me, honestly, that I would ever find a job in private practice. I thought that would be impossible. And when I did, I fell in love with the law in a different kind of way, because representing clients to me and hearing their stories and helping them achieve their dreams, whatever they are, was infinitely fascinating to me.
Well, for women, I'm considerably older than you are, Roberta, so...
Yeah, oh,
so
right.
think of Sandra Day O'Connor.
Yes.
Very high in her class at Stanford Law School.
I think second.
Rehnquist was first.
Right. I know. He actually reminded me of that once. Because a law firm in Albuquerque hadn't offered him a job.
So Sandra did the same thing, and no one was interested. So she volunteered to work for a county attorney in California and said, I will work free for the first 4 months. Then, if you think that it's worthwhile, you can put me on the payroll. And that's how... In my case, I got a federal clerkship this way. A professor who was then at Columbia Law School and was in charge of clerkships for third-year students, he proposed, he called up every judge in the Southern District of New York, and there were no takers until one who had always taken his clerks from Columbia. And this professor, a very well-known constitutional scholar, Jerry Gunther, said to this judge, I think that Ruth Ginsburg would work out well for you. The judge's first response was, she has a four-year-old daughter, how can I take a chance? So the professor said, give her a chance, and if she doesn't work out, there's a young man in her class who is going to work for a downtown firm. He'll step in and take over. So that was the carrot. There was a stick. The stick was, if you don't give her a chance, I will never recommend another Columbia student to you. So it worked out. It was I clerked for Judge Palmieri for 2 years. And after that, so it was important for women to get the first job. Once they got the job, the next one was easier. So once Justice Palmieri was able to tell law firms, yeah, she's always there when I need her, even on a Sunday.
Well, let me ask you, Justice Ginsburg, some questions about the court, because I know everybody is riveted these days by, because some of all of the cases that come are deeply important to the litigants, but it turns out that many of the cases are deeply important to the whole country and sometimes to the world. And I've been so fascinated that in the face of total lack of civility in our political discourse, much has been made, and I know this from personal experience, having been lucky enough to talk to many of the justices, that in spite of the deepest possible divides on legal issues of the times, the justices managed to maintain great civility. And everybody, I think, who reads knows about your great friendship with Justice Scalia, with whom there could not be greater differences. Everybody in this room might not know that there is now an opera, Scalia and Ginsburg. I am not making this up.
So a lot of people ask me, why is Scalia first? But there's a simple answer. We do everything in the court by seniority order. We sit, even at lunch, we sit in seniority order. And so Scalia is ahead of Ginsburg in that way.
So Justice Ginsburg, explain to us how it is that nine human beings, very different from one another, and clearly there's a divide in the world view and the constitutional view of subsets of that, we're anxious to know how you maintain your personal accord so that you can actually get something done. And in part, I ask you that question because I'm anxious to know so that maybe we could explain it to the Congress. So.
The number one reason is that we revere the institution for which we work. And we would not like it to see it lose the respect that it has in the country and other that makes us different. There's only nine of us. Compared to other branches of the government, the executive, the legislature, there are member of Congress. We'll have a large staff of people. We have just the four law clerks, a couple of secretaries, and a chamber's aide, and that's it. I guess we're about the last people in government that still do our own work. and when you come to our conference, when we meet to decide what cases we will take up for review, or we meet to discuss argued cases, the first thing we do, we go around the room, each justice shakes hands with every other, and we look each other in the eye, and it's a way of saying, even if you circulated that nasty dissent yesterday, you know, we are all in this together. And as I said, we revere the court as an institution. There are many things that add to our collegiality. But one thing is, there's a lot of togetherness on the court. So sometimes if I go abroad to have an exchange with judges from high courts in other countries, I will travel with one, two, three, four, even five of my colleagues. There's a famous picture of Justice Scalia and me on an elephant in Rajasthan. Last September, we had an exchange with the Supreme Court of Canada, and in midwinter with the European Court of Justice. So we travel together. One now tradition that I'm very proud of is we have two musicales a year at the court, one in the fall and one in the spring. And we have had artists who are well known to the Santa Fe Opera crowd. Susan Graham has sung at the court. We tend to have opera people in the fall and instrumentalists in the spring. So we had Yo-Yo Ma this spring. It's something that brings us together. We have the May musicale is timed just after the court finishes sitting and before we go into that really heavy-duty season when we're the court. One of the things that's good about the court is we don't leave town for the summer until everything that's come in the first Monday in October is out. Every opinion has to be released or we don't have a summer vacation. So those are some of the things that keep us together. You know, because there are only nine, we're kind of like a family. And I think I can illustrate that best by reflecting on my two bouts with cancer. With the first one, it was I had surgery for colorectal cancer in September. The court was going to sit the first Monday in October. Justice O'Connor was my model and my inspiration. She was on the bench 9 days after her breast cancer surgery. And so she was my number one advisor. She said, now, Ruth, you schedule your chemotherapy on Friday, and that way you'll be over it and can get back to work on Monday. But all of my colleagues rallied around me at that time and made it possible for me to get through that term without missing a sitting.
Well, you know, I think that points out we have heard from many people in Congress the difficulty because they're now flying back and forth so much they don't have those opportunities to be together and to know each other in a different way. And I know our Senator Tom Udall, whose father, of course, was there a long time when things were more civil, has worked very hard to try to get people to across party lines to have dinner together. And I think you're right. I think the combination of actually knowing the human being and understanding that we are all indeed, especially in this democracy, in it together makes a huge difference. So let me ask you what I would have thought was kind of an inside baseball question until I saw John Stewart, from whom I get most of my news these days. And he was responding to, I think it was Justice Scalia's a speech that he'd given about the fact that you interpreted the Constitution and statutes, the words just said right what they meant, and it was completely obvious. And John Stewart put on the screen, Justice Ginsburg, a large stop sign. And he said, all that says is stop. And so we would be in gridlock for our entire life because it doesn't say stop and look both ways and then you can go. It doesn't say this is a four-way stop, please take turns. It just says stop. And that if you viewed the Constitution and statutes through that lens, it would be a little bit hard to actually ever get anything done. So could you tell us a little bit about your view of the rules of strict construction of the Constitution and of statutes as well, and of original intent, and how you try to apply it as you do your work?
I count myself an originalist in the way I view the Constitution. And I, by the way, I carry this around with me, the U.S. Constitution, wherever I go in the world. So it starts by saying, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. Well, think about who were we the people of the United States in 1787 when the Constitution was adopted. They were white, they were male, and they owned property. I think that the founders, they expected the country and this Constitution should survive, that their idea was we had to continue to perfect and make this a more perfect union. So let's take my favorite amendment, the 14th Amendment. And my favorite clause in the 14th Amendment reads, nor shall any state deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. Now, think back to 1868, when the 14th Amendment became part of the Constitution. If you ask the framers of that amendment, the equal protection of the laws, does that mean that women have the right to vote? And the answer in 1868 would be, of course not. They're not part of the political community. But we are perfecting or making the union more perfect, and we get finally the 19th Amendment in 1920. I think the genius of the United States is that over now much more than two centuries, sometimes turbulent decades, we the people has become ever more embracive. I mean, Native Americans were included among the we the people.
Right.
So I think that the founders, their dream must have been to see this more perfect union evolve. They were held back by the times in which they lived. So how do we capture that in the opera Scalia Ginsburg? the difference between a strict literal interpretation and what I call sensible. So Scalia has the opening aria. It's a rage aria. It's very Handelian. And the words go like this. The justices are blind. How can they possibly spout this? The Constitution says absolutely nothing about this. And then I answer and tell him that he is searching for bright line solutions to problems that don't have easy answers. But the great thing about our Constitution is that, like our society, it can evolve. And then I, well, that's the gist of it. It is a wonderfully comic opera. It's based roughly on the magic flute.
I'm going to have to think about that for a minute.
Well, in one scene, Justice Scalia is confined to a dark dungeon for excessive dissenting. And then I enter to rescue him through a glass ceiling.
Well, that leads exactly to the next question I wanted to ask you, which is, what moves a justice to read their dissent from the bench? Because it isn't often done, but as you did in the Hobby Lobby case.
Yeah, the pattern for the court is that the author of the majority opinion will summarize the decision from the bench and then say if there have been other writings, Justice so-and-so has filed a dissenting opinion. The dissent isn't summarized from the bench. But maybe once or twice a term, a justice may consider that the court wasn't just that the court got it wrong, but it was egregiously wrong. And you want everybody to know that. So you will summarize your dissent from the bench. And I think the best example recently of that, in my case, was Lily Ledbetter's suit. Now, this was a woman who worked as an area manager for a Goodyear tire plant. She was the first woman to have that job. She discovered after she'd been working there nearly 20 years, well, she found a slip of paper in her mailbox. It had numbers on it, and the numbers were the pay of every man doing the job that she did. And the most junior man was making considerably more per hour than she was. So she decided, I have a pretty good case under Title VII, our principal anti-discrimination in employment law. She brings the case, and she has a jury trial, and she wins a substantial award. Goodyear Tire brought the case up the ladder and finally to the Supreme Court. And its argument was, this law, this Title VII, says you must file your complaint within 180 days after the discriminatory incident. And Lily Ledbetter filed her complaint years and years after the first discriminatory incident. Well, her view of this was, what do you mean? I get a paycheck every month. Every check I get is lower than the men doing. So it's each month the discrimination is renewed. Five members of the Supreme Court didn't get it. And they said she had 180 days from the first incident. Well, what would the first incident have been? The employer didn't give out the pay figures. Or even if she had complained, the answer, the defense, you can be certain, would have been, it had nothing to do with Lily Ledbetter being female. It's just she didn't do the job as well as the men. But when she's been in the job, and year after year she gets good performance ratings, they can no longer defend by saying she doesn't do the job as well. At that point, she has a winnable case. And the court said she sued too late. So when I read my dissent from the bench, I tried to explain what life was like for a woman who was a newcomer for a field that had been occupied only by men. And my tagline was, the ball is now in Congress's court to correct the error into which my colleagues have fallen. I mean, my message was, Congress, I think all along you meant that a Lily Ledbetter would win a case like hers. But if you didn't speak clearly enough, amend Title VII to make it crystal clear that a woman in Lily's situation, she is discriminated against every month that her paycheck is lower than that of a man doing the same job. And with record speed, Congress passed the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. So in my dissent was pitched to not a future court, but to the Congress. You can do that when you're dealing with a statute. Congress can fix the court's misinterpretation of a statute. Congress can't fix our interpretation of the Constitution. Because on that, on constitutional interpretation, the court has the last word. So then, you mentioned Hobby Lobby. Your pitch is to a future court that will understand that the earlier court got it wrong. And we have seen repeatedly throughout the history of our country the Supreme Court having made some errors that later courts corrected. I think of the most dreadful case the court ever decided, the Dred Scott case. And the court said, no person brought to the United States from Africa in chains, no such person and no descendant of such person will ever be a U.S. citizen. Well, we fought a civil war to take care of that. And then there was the so-called separate but equal doctrine. There were the free speech cases during World War I when Holmes and Brandeis upholding people's right to think, speak, and write without Big Brother government telling them what is correct speech. They spoke for two justices, Holmes and Brandeis. All of their decisions today, all of those dissenting decisions, are the law of the land. So a dissenter is looking to a later court to correct what she sees as the error her colleagues have made.
We hope it's not too later. So, in the case of Hobby Lobby. Let me ask you about the face of the court and the interactions of the court. You were the second woman appointed to the court, so you and Justice O'Connor served together. Then there was a time when you were the only woman on the court, and now there are three women on the court. Does it make a difference?
It makes an enormous difference. For one thing, if you come to the court, how do you perceive the bench? In the years that Justice O'Connor and I overlapped, invariably one lawyer or another would address me as Justice O'Connor. They knew that there was a woman on the Supreme Court. Sandra was there all alone for 12 years. So a woman's voice, that must be Justice O'Connor, even though we don't look alike, we don't speak alike. Then when Sandra retired and I was all alone, the perception, the portrait of the court was altogether wrong because here were these eight men, all of a certain size, and this little woman. Well, now I sit toward the middle by virtue of seniority. Justice Kagan is at my left, Justice Sotomayor at my right. So when the school children come to observe proceedings, they see a bench that women are part of. And no one nowadays calls me Justice Kagan or Justice Sotomayor. And my newest colleagues are very actively engaged in the colloquy. They are not shrinking violets. In fact, last year, not this year, but the term before this one, Justice Sotomayor beat out Justice Scalia as the justice who asked the most questions during an oral argument.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm a little bit sensitive about this, since last week when my husband was trying to tell me a story and I interrupted him one too many times, he said, "Who do you think you are, Justice Sotomayor?" I hope you tell her that, or I didn't really think I was, but tell us a little bit, what difference do you see between the women's movement when you were active in it and I was active in it? I've said before, when we were fighting here to get a state equal rights amendment passed, which I'm very proud to say we did after I testified once in front of a very hostile But ultimately, understanding committee and the legislature, as I walked out, actually a woman who had heard me testify on the way out said to me, "Your children will end up being juvenile delinquents." And those of you that know my lawyer daughter, Jenny, know it's true. But only for the best causes. So what difference do you see then? We were all engaged deeply in trying to make change. And someone asked me once, given where I am now in life in all ways, if there was still discrimination in some ways. And my answer was, when I started out, not a day went by that something didn't happen that I sort of noticed. Although the truth is, often I thought it was my failing, not other things. And then it got to be a week, and after a while, maybe it was a month. And just as people calling you by the wrong justice's name, I think there is discrimination now, and women who don't think there is are simply inattentive. But I wondered what your view of that was and what your view of the difference in the women's movement now is.
And now the discrimination is more subtle. In the 70s, all the targets were out there. The gender lines in the law were overt. It was the closed door era. And the object, I think, of the feminist movement in the 70s was to open all those doors so that there wasn't a single occupation that was closed to women. So the targets were there. Now, as I said, we have anti-discrimination in employment law. It's supposed to be equal opportunity. And yet there is lingering discrimination. It's kind of what some people call unconscious bias. And my best example of that is a symphony orchestra. In my growing up years, I never saw a woman, or maybe a harpist, but otherwise not in the symphony orchestra. And the auditionist said they could always tell the difference between a woman playing and a man playing. Someone came up with the brilliant and simple idea, let's drop a curtain, so the auditioners won't know whether a man is playing or a woman. And that's when you saw the big change. I mean, Howard Taubman, who was the music critic for the New York Times, he said, blindfold me, I can tell whether it's a woman playing the piano or a man. Well, they did that, and he couldn't. He got all mixed up. And then someone my son knows very well, when I was telling this story, it was Jennifer Coe. She said, you left one thing out. And what you left out is when we audition shoeless. So they won't hear a woman's heels coming. But that's an example of the auditioners weren't trying to discriminate against women, but it was another good example of that. This was a Title VII case against, I think it was AT&T, for women who were seeking promotion to middle management jobs. And the women on all the tests, they did fine. Till the very last one, which was called the Total Person Test. And that would be the interviewer speaking to the candidate for promotion. And lo and behold, people got through it. Almost entirely male. The interviewer who was giving the total person test, like most people, felt more comfortable with people who looked like he did, had the same background as he did, a little uncomfortable in dealing with a woman. She was strange. So it's rooting out that unconscious bias. That's much harder than saying, well, here's a law that says women can't be police officers or firefighters. You could knock out those laws a lot easier than you can deal with this unconscious bias.
And do you find, when you speak to young women, which I know you do a lot, that they understand the need to continually be observant and active about these issues, or not so much?
many young women think, there are no closed doors. I can do anything I want. I've never encountered any discrimination in law school or anyplace else. And then I think, sadly, wait until the baby comes. And then they come to understand that it's not yet fully equal. So I'm hoping perhaps some of my court's recent decisions will turn young women on to the fact that they haven't reached nirvana, that there's a way to go.
I hope so too. Now, let me ask you one last question. For years, you have shouldered the cause for individual rights, not just women, but all people who are discriminated against, which I think it's so important that all of us understand that if you've been the object of discrimination of some kind, it makes you exquisitely sensitive to the pain that other people feel when you know they aren't found wanting because of their abilities, but because of something else that that happens to them. What is your charge to each of us? Here we have people who have signed up for a day of discussion about issues involving women and risk and business and the arts and science. What charge? You were our general before, so now, how would you send each of us into battle to make this country a better place for women, which will make it a better place for men as well?
One obligation of every citizen is sadly neglected by some of us, and that is the obligation to vote. You know, the percentage in the United States is... So, for people who would like to see change or think that things aren't going the right way, the first thing you must do is to express your view at the ballot box. So, encouraging everyone to participate in our democracy in that most basic way, by voting. And then for anyone, whatever field you're in, you must have a passion about something that matters to other people. You know, whether it's ending racial discrimination, discrimination against women, against the handicapped, the environment. Work for something outside yourself, something that you care deeply about, and that will make things a little better for other people. I know I've had tremendous satisfaction from the great opportunity that I had. I could never have gotten that satisfaction out of a high-paying job.
Well, that is quite a charge for all of us. Let me just say, most precious Justice Ginsburg, in Japan, they call people national treasures. And I was thinking about you in preparing for this day, in which I must tell you I spent so much time reading your opinions that I hope nobody tells my law firm. I think you are our national treasure, and it's not only because of your work at the epicenter of our nation's conflicts, but it's how you conduct yourself and how you have conducted yourself at every stage of your life. You are an icon, which is a word that is used too easily, but in fact you are, as a woman, as a human being, and as a great judge, something that we each aspire to, and I want to thank you for all of us.
Thank you.
We've been listening to Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Roberta Cooper Ramo, president of the American Law Association. They spoke at the inaugural symposium of the Women's International Study Center here in Santa Fe on the 15th of August of this year.